behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bullen.
Ben, we've got a topic today that we're going to kind of closely follow a list. We've done these in the past.
Yeah.
And it's going to kind of maybe spin off into maybe some other things towards the end of the podcast.
Right.
Some superlatives.
And probably spin off into a sequel after that.
Well, maybe. Yeah, that's right. We talked about doing some additional research beyond this one. So there's a little bit more beyond what we're going to talk about today coming, you know, down the pipeline somewhere.
Right. So here's what happened. We found a list. You found a list and shared it with me about cars that have changed the face of the automotive world in maybe some unlikely ways, and you and I don't completely agree with everything on this list.
Yeah, I guess not. I mean, there's some nitpicking that we can do along the way, I guess. And I don't want to be too picky about it, but I just want to say that, you know, I rarely trust lists of firsts, you know, anything that says we're first to do this or we're the best to do this. Automotive superlative lists are often incorrect in that, you know, there's always something else, or there's always someone else who's tried it before. Now, the difference is with this list, and this comes from an article in Popular Mechanics. And the title of the article is 10 Unlikely Autos That Change Cars Forever. And the unlikely autos part is what's really key here in that, you know, some of these cars that you're going to hear about, they're really, I mean, in some respects, they're kind of unremarkable, but in other ways, they're incredibly remarkable in that they did change the way people did things. These are like the automotive pioneers vehicles.
The groundbreakers.
The groundbreakers, the test beds, the proving grounds that led to great advancements in automotive manufacturing and the industry, really, and that allowed other manufacturers to say, yeah, we can do that as well. We can try to do it a little better. Mm-hmm. And it's something that has changed along the way. And I've got a kind of an example of this, Ben, just right off the top that I want to kind of share that maybe will give people an idea of what we're talking about here. Because and we're not talking about, when we say superlatives and we say like firsts or the best to do something, a lot of times what you'll think of is like cars that claim to have like the longest wheelbase car, right? Something
right,
like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So the longest wheelbase, if you take that, someone could always top that. Somebody could say, you know, somebody could build a car that's 1 inch longer, you know, that has a wheelbase that's half an inch longer than that and say that this is the longest American car production wheelbase that we have. I probably screwed up the way I said that, but you know, someone could always top that in some way. But let's say that you have a car that is the first to use electric power windows. Well, that car is always going to be the first vehicle to have electric power windows, and no one can ever take that away. It's always going to be the first to do that, and it's always going to be an advancement, you know, something like that that we talk about that, you know, other manufacturers have, you know, grabbed onto and said, that's a good idea. I'm going to also put electric power windows into my car. And by the way, the first one to do that was the 1938 Buick Y-Job that Harley Earl designed. So, you know, that goes way, way back. But, you know, the cars we're going to talk about, you know, you're not going to be, you know, blown away by the type of vehicle it is.
Right.
But what's interesting about them is, you know, the one little bit of technology that sets them apart from every other car, and it was the first to do that, and it did lead to industry-changing ideas.
And as we dive right in, let me go ahead and get this off at the top to save some people some emails. One of the biggest caveats, one of the most common asterisks in these sorts of lists will always be production car. So it's very difficult for anyone to find the literal first example of a car that had an innovation.
And as we're talking, and I just want to clear this as well, and this is just so that we avoid maybe 100 emails, Ben, that there are qualifiers to each one of these. Now, throughout this whole thing, there are going to be qualifiers, like the first large production unibody truck, which is what we're going to talk about first.
Right.
And you heard me say, large production unibody truck. Now, it's going to be, there's also going to be small production unibody trucks, and there's going to be small production unibody cars, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. This is very important that the qualifiers are there. I don't know if we're going to be able to read all of them. So if you don't hear something, just understand that this list was put together by somebody who did the research, obviously.
Yeah.
We do have a little bit of quibble with some of it, but I'm just going to kind of leave that out because there's some, I guess, some variations of these things that I've heard about in the past. Like, let's say that, you know, we're going to mention the Jeep Cherokee and the unibody design first.
Yeah, 1984 Jeep Cherokee.
Exactly. Well, there's, you know, other cars that used unibody before that, and there are other trucks that used unibody before that. The difference is that this is the first large production unibody truck.
Right.
So things like that along the way. don't hold us to so much detail because we're not going to be able to read these exactly. Mm-hmm. And you know, hopefully you'll get the point across that these are important vehicles.
Right. So the gist of that one is that it makes a, it's a different welding process. It keeps a stiffer chassis. Mm-hmm. So that's great because it weighs less and it's more sturdy than other competitors.
Exactly. So lower weight, stiffer chassis. That's the important thing. And again, the 1984 Jeep Cherokee, it's not a particularly amazing vehicle in any way, sure, other than, you know, it had this unibody design, which was, that's pretty remarkable.
And I like to call that a quiet innovation.
I guess so. And then another quiet one.
Yeah.
Is the 2001 Nissan Pathfinder. And it has what they call autonomous off-roading, but really what that means is it had a unique electronic ascent and descent control for off-roading.
Yeah. It had specifically, like, the brake system was able to allow the driver to be less skilled.
I guess so, yeah, because if you're going downhill off-roading, you typically wouldn't keep your foot on the brake for a long period of time because it would overheat, it would skid, it wouldn't work. I guess in this one, you can have a little bit, I guess more of a clumsy touch with the pedals, I suppose, with the brake pedal rather.
And the accelerator,
because the accelerator on this was something different as well. It had a unique traction control system that allowed it to, you know, when you're going uphill, Ben, you often want to be like real light touch. You want to have kind of a feather touch on these if you're off-roading again. You know, loose surface, gravel, whatever it is, sand, anything. I guess with this one, you can pretty much floor it and it will kind of counteract what you're doing and appropriately adjust the torque level to allow it to slowly climb the hill. This seems totally counterintuitive to me that it would work that way. I mean, yeah. I wouldn't want to floor it if I'm headed up a loose material hill, I guess, in an off-roading situation. Yeah, it seems dangerous.
Want a low gear and
very, very slow, light touch on the accelerator. But again, this 2001 Nissan Pathfinder, it had this unique, electronic ascent and descent control, and it was the first in the industry to do that. And a lot of 4x4 manufacturers followed suit with that later on.
All right, now let's go to the next one, the Toyota Celica rounded design. Mm-hmm. I have a bone to pick with this one. It's 1989.
Sure.
Okay, so the whole idea is the caveats in here are that not in 1989, not one new panel on the Celica had a crease or sharp angle. So Toyota got rid of the Celica's previous sharper angled shape, and they set up stamping presses, right, so that they could make these perfect these perfect compound curved cars, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So yep. The innovation is curved stamping.
It was a more complex stamping design, I guess.
I have so much less of a problem with that.
Well, I guess so, but you know, they're saying that they want it to be, every panel was curved. It wasn't flat. It wasn't like just, you could hammer something out on an anvil. You know, it's what it looked like in the past. I mean, I know it was refined and it was actually a pretty design. I like squared off designs from the 80s. I think they're really cool. Like think about the late 80s, Volkswagen GTI designs and the Rabbits and things like that. Those were kind of squared off, really kind of cool looking designs, like the, I don't know, like the Porsche 914.
I just learned this about you, huh? Are you into those?
Yeah, I kind of like those older cars. Those are kind of interesting looking, and a lot of street tuner performance type cars that, you know, these retro cars that people are doing, I think they look really cool. And you know, they have the flat front ends and they're squared off fenders and they're kind of cool looking.
Okay.
But in 89, Toyota came out with a Celica that was completely rounded. And one of the main things about this thing was, I guess, and it wasn't really so much a design that they wanted, to go rounded or anything like that.
Right.
It was just that they thought, well, we've got these Korean manufacturers that are going to copy these things because Korean car companies were, I don't know, relatively new at the time. I mean, they've been around, but, you know, they were starting to copy some of the Japanese designs.
Yep.
And copy them, I mean, so exactly that, you know, these knockoff cars were becoming quite a problem.
Essentially reverse engineering.
Exactly.
The process.
And why would you not buy something that looked the same, that was a lot cheaper from Korea versus something that was more expensive from Japan? Why would you do that? So they made these curved designs so that they couldn't be mimicked.
Yeah, here's my only beef with this. I understand. I am much more behind this and on board when you say, you know, innovative metal stamping process. But just saying rounded design?
I guess so, because
irritates me a little.
There were a lot of other cars that were rounded as well, but.
Yes.
I don't know. That is a tough one, I guess.
It's the process they use to make it, and I respect that, but I just wanna lay the, I just want to lay the point down there that this is an innovation in stamping.
Yeah.
This is not an aesthetic innovation.
Well, they called it complex compound curve stamping. So,
right.
So that's the difference, is that it's the first one to use that. So let's move on here. Tell you what, let's knock out a couple really quick here.
Sure. Let's go,
Corvette.
Yeah.
Can you talk about Corvette?
Always.
The 2005 Chevy Corvette and what they call automotive neurology. What it really comes down to is the body and component monitoring for the entire car. And oddly enough, that wasn't done before this, which is strange. I mean, you would think that, you know, the bus communication systems that are in cars now, you'd think they would be far more advanced even in 2005 than they were. But really, this one led to, when it debuted in 2005, it was kind of the first of its kind to monitor and control the entire car at one time, which, I'm just astonished by that. You would think that Cadillac or somebody like that would come up with something prior to that.
Before 2005.
Exactly, and that they would have launched it on a more of a luxury vehicle or something, you know, higher end. I know Corvette's a pretty high-end, expensive car, but you think they would launch it on a luxury model. The next one, a 1993 Isuzu pickup.
This is a weird one because it's not about a car's new innovation. It's about being the last one to have a carburetor.
It was a holdout. Yeah, it was the last one to use a carbureted engine for sale in the United States, I should say. Because I think there were others that, you know, maybe even still, who knows, that are making carbureted cars. But, you know, after this, after the 93 Isuzu pickup, they switched over to electronic ignition systems and, you know, these high pressure fuel pumps and, you know, the carb's place, I guess, was, for fuel delivery was ousted by electronic fuel injection, completely at that point in the U.S. And then after that, no carbureted cars. So again, it's a holdout.
Oh, I have a question.
What's that?
This reminds me. Which brings us to the 1994 Oldsmobile Aurora, their innovation being origami sheet metal.
Now that sounds so strange when you
Doesn't
say it,
it
that way. Origami sheet metal.
This car can also be a crane.
I mean, that's so weird, but it's 20 years old at this point, right?
Right.
So 20 years ago, they were making this car called the Oldsmobile Aurora, and I think it had a big V8 engine in it. It was a strong car.
Yeah.
But what was unique about this was the way that they put the sheet metal together, right?
Yeah, so they fold it and they layer it and then they weld it into these boxed sections. And previously, the manufacturers had just been using heavy beams. So this does two good things. It makes the body much stiffer, and then parts of the car that used to just keep rain and wind and the elements away from passengers actually became useful in the case of an accident.
Yeah, they were crush zones. They were the crumple zones that we've heard so much about. And it wasn't just, you know, that they're building big open boxes. We're talking about the way they actually folded the metal into the different sections to make it work as an additional buffer.
Right.
So, you know, these are amazing. It's an amazing advancement, really, and it was amazing that they hadn't really thought of it prior to this. I mean, 1994, you think that's not too long ago, 20 years, but,
yeah.
I mean, the body became more than just kind of a pretty cover over, you know, all the guts underneath. It's part of the part of the design, part of the production, part of the protection, the energy absorption that that goes into every vehicle that they make, you know, that hopefully keeps their you know, the car buying public alive, right?
Right.
And that's what they want to do, because they want you to come back and buy more cars.
They can only be return customers if they can return.
Exactly, right. So let's move on to this is a really good one, I think. This is a great pick. Now, the 1983 Audi Quattro and its four-wheel drive system. And now I want to make sure that people understand that they weren't the first car to use four-wheel drive. And Subaru,
yes.
I mean, I guess they mentioned here in the article Subaru. Now, Subaru was doing it already, but it was kind of what they called a clunky system because, you know, well, they did have a modern suspension and, you know, four-wheel drive system and all that. They still had to use an extra transfer case shift lever to get into that four-wheel drive. So it was a bit of a complex, clunky system.
And it was
used
part-time.
Exactly. And it was similar, but trucks used live axles. This was using more of a modern suspension. But when Audi came out with their full-time four-wheel drive system, what they called the Quattro system. And they demonstrated, you know, the benefits of this in many different ways. I think one of the ways was they climbed a ski jump. You remember that commercial? Amazing commercial. It's really cool. If you haven't seen the classic commercial where an Audi Quattro climbs the ski jump, and I think they recreated this.
And that's real, right?
It's real. It's exactly right. There's no trickery involved in that other than the way they hooked it at the top. They recreated that recently as well for, you know, some anniversary edition, but, Audi's full-time four-wheel drive system or all-wheel drive system, the Quattro system in 1983 was just a, it was head and shoulders above everybody else that was doing it, including Subaru, because it was just a much easier system to use. And I know Subaru's caught up. You know, they're doing something similar now. But, Audi has always been just kind of a standout in the all-wheel drive arena.
And speaking of standout, that takes us to the 1984 Lincoln Continental Mark 7. Now, this might be, on the surface, this is going to sound like it's meaningless. Mm-hmm. You know, the first American car, volume produced, that's our asterisk,
sure.
American car, to feature non-sealed beam, flush molded headlights.
Yeah. And anti-lock braking.
And anti-lock braking.
So it had two advancements. Now, I know what you're saying about it seems a little bit fluffy, I guess, to mention.
The anti-lock braking is huge.
Well, that's big.
The flash, the lamps might seem, it might seem like not that important, but I think you know where I'm going with this.
I do. It was a huge styling improvement because prior to that point, think about what the front ends of cars looked like. They were relatively flat,
yep.
Or they had a concave look to them. They had individual seal beam headlights that, you know, like the square or round, and it was just a really unaerodynamic possibility, I guess, for every car, really, because they had to design that in somehow. And they had, you know, some that would cover, and they had some that would flip up like the Corvettes would. I understand that. But this was the first time that they had these non-seal beam flush-mounted headlights in a design, and it really led to a lot of different advancements. I mean, think about all the cars that have that type of design from that era, from 1984 through, oh my gosh, let's say all the way through, pretty darn close to even now. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know what year they stopped doing something like that.
Right.
A lot of them now have, you know, the plexiglass covers that are fading in the sunlight. You know, they have all that oxidation problem. But, this was a big advancement in design, and, it definitely deserves a mention on the list.
I think so. Well, what do you think about the 1988 Mazda RX-7 convertible?
This one is kind of simple, I guess, in the innovation, mm-hmm. really, but it was a big deal because, there's a guy, I guess, that worked for Mazda.
Oh, yeah. Takaharu Kobayakawa.
Very good, Ben. I wouldn't have tried that myself. They called him Kobe, I think, for short, right?
Yeah, I should just say Kobe.
And he had worked with Mazda to create a winning Le Mans, winning Le Mans vehicle, I guess, in 1991. So, you know, he's got racing background, I guess, and he's an engineer for Mazda, and he worked on the RX-7 convertible.
And he loves to ski.
That's the other thing, is he loves to ski. So, you know, this is his idea, is that he's going to be able to pull up to the ski lodge someday in his convertible comfortably, I guess, with the top down, because it's kind of a silly idea, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
it's cool.
You got a convertible. You want to be able to drive it in the wintertime, but you really can't because it's just so darn cold. You know what? Have you ever heard of wind buffeting? You know what that is?
Yeah. Do you mean when the wind kind of has like that after blow, like it goes over you, but then it hits you again
in
the back?
Yeah, it's like it's coming from the back end of the vehicle, and it's just pounding the back of your head, and it's getting stuff all over the windshield and everything, you know, from the inside. Well, he decided that, you know, if I could just create a wind deflector that would stop that buffeting, then the heat vents would work much better. You know, they'd be able to keep me nice and warm. I'd be able to have the top down, and it would be a simple, simple thing, right? So he decides to invent this thing. It's just really a simple wind blocker, but it helped him, you know, achieve whatever he wanted to do there. He was able to, you know, drive around a convertible in the wintertime and be relatively comfortable because of this wind blocker design, and we've seen that in a lot of different cars.
Yeah, almost every other convertible manufacturer picked this one up. Our very last one, this is the 1989 Nissan Maxima. And this is a little bit interesting here because come with us to the 80s in Japan. The Japanese excise tax limited all the cars sold in Japan to a maximum of 66.5 inches wide. So this really gave Japanese automakers a blow below the belt when they were trying to sell luxury cars in America.
Yeah, I like that you said come with us to the 1980s because you got to remember in the 1980s, anything prior to 1989, any import that you saw was typically very small compared to some of the American vehicles that we had here and some of the other vehicles. I mean, even from other countries that were being imported as well. So the Japanese imports were very, very small. They seemed like they were compact or even subcompact design mainly. They were unable to compete in the luxury car division or the luxury car market. And you can imagine that, you know, this kind of hurts because, you know, it's a big group that they want to be a part of here in the United States because there's a lot of money to be made there. There's a lot of cars to be sold in the luxury cars in America, right? So Acura Legend, I guess I should say, prior to 1989 was kind of a small car. I mean, it was considered almost like a compact car or something. It was definitely not a luxury car, even though that's a luxury brand of Honda.
And it wasn't taken too seriously, but finally Nissan changed it in 1989. They introduced the Maxima, which was 69 inches wide, and this is officially the breakout of Japanese cars to worldwide or larger sizes.
Exactly. So they eliminated that Japanese excise tax. They said, you know, you can make a car because what is 66 and a half inches? That's like 5.5 feet, right?
Yeah.
Well, 69 inches, that's closer to 6 feet wide. You wouldn't think that'd make a huge difference, but it really does in the interior car. I mean, that makes a big difference. So, you know, able to compete with, American luxury cars, European luxury cars, that's a big boost for them. It's something that, you know, is something that you can't put a number on something like this because it changes everything from that point forward.
That's true. And Scott, speaking of changing everything from this point forward, I've got some bad news, my friend.
What's that?
I think we're going to have to change our strategy and put our superlatives in the next podcast.
That's totally fine. I think because we've got a great list of automotive firsts that we want to cover.
Yeah.
And I think our listeners will be excited about hearing that.
And you know, our buddy Jonathan is, I think has the studio next.
I think he's knocking at the window behind me.
No, he's not.
He will be soon.
He will be soon. So we're going to go ahead and make some room for our buddies at Tech Stuff, for Jonathan and Laura to come in. Maybe we'll have them on a show in the future. We hope you've enjoyed our look at this list, and we want to know what you think. Do these cars deserve the accolades they're getting? What are some automotive firsts that didn't make it on this list?
You got to remember far-reaching automotive firsts.
Far-reaching, yes. Big changes.
Big changes that led to industry-wide developments.
Perfect way to say it, Scott. So write to us on Facebook and write to us on Twitter. Check out carstuffshow.com, where we have some fantastic stuff going on online. And send us an email directly. Our address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.